It's wonderful to welcome you all here this morning. You'll find the bulletin on page 8 does have a brief outline of what we're talking about this morning. It's not a comprehensive outline. It's a little, you'll just have to work with me on it. But there is room there for you to write some things down if you'd like. Warm welcome to those of you that are visitors with us this morning or guests. We are closing in right now on our final sermon. This is the final sermon in our series on Genesis. And we haven't looked at all of Genesis. We've looked at the first 12 chapters in detail. And then since about Christmas, we've looked at the lives of the patriarchs and matriarchs and their children, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And this morning we're going to finish off with one last look at Jacob and how God deals with him. Genesis is a great book. It's a great book. It is a way for us as Christians, if you are a Christian, to look into your own history. So the history of every Christian is actually the history of Israel. Now there's a bit of a culture jump, right? When we come to Genesis, we're reading about things that seem strange and mystical and unlike our time. And so many in the church today actually have little knowledge or even little interest in their true roots. We don't live in the world of the patriarchs and matriarchs today. And so it's easy to let the richness and texture of our ancestors' faith slip away. So before we dive into this amazing chapter in Genesis, let me give you 5 reasons why Genesis is a great book and so foundational for us. And these are 5 things that I hope you've seen over the last several months as we've preached our way through this part of Genesis. Number 1, our ancestors in Genesis were people on the move who approached life with boldness, drive, and expectation. Their faith wasn't an idea to be contemplated, but an experience to be lived. A pilgrimage. Everything for the ancient Israelites was theological. There was no division between the sacred and the secular. All things were under God's dominion. The existence of God was never questioned. Number 2, Genesis presents true stories about real people. As Ben said last week, these are not sanitized or curated or photoshopped lives. All the guts and grime are here. What makes Genesis and the Bible so vital is its realism. These are people just like us. Number 3, Genesis shows that the essence of true godliness is tied primarily to a relationship, not to a creed. The Lord is the God of Israel, and Israel is the people of God. You might remember that Jesus initially appointed the 12 that they might be with him. And so Genesis reveals to us that God is in relationship with his covenant partners. Number 4. Now, all of this matters because the church grew from these Hebrew roots. Jesus was born to Jewish parents. The Bible of his day was the Old Testament. In New Testament thought, the history of the church is an extension of the history of Israel. Paul the Apostle wrote in Greek, but thought like a Jew. And if that's true, then to be a believer today is to live a granular and gritty pilgrimage with Jesus by faith in his word and promise, just like the patriarchs and matriarchs gradually learned to do by God's grace. And number five, Genesis is a great book because it reminds us that the life of faith is impossible without God. It is absolutely His power and promise that drives history and salvation forward. It is humanly impossible to do what God does every day through His living word. We look back at our time in Genesis and we remember that Abraham's wife Sarah was barren. Isaac's wife Rebecca was also barren. And Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, was also barren. The promised land, Canaan, was already occupied. Family dysfunction, sibling rivalry, and actions of supreme self-sufficiency jeopardized God's promises over and over. And yet, God prevails, moving His plan forward despite and in His unruly people. He prevails by power, but also by extreme grace, covenant faithfulness, and personal love. So those are five things that I've taken from our series in Genesis so far. There are others, of course, and I hope that that will serve as a point of reflection for us. Now let's dive into chapter 32 here and look at the story as Doug read it for us this morning. Jacob, you may remember, is an ambitious schemer and an unethical deceiver. Last week, Ben said that Jacob is not a magnetic protagonist. Good, way to go, Ben. That was a good phrase. I like that. Not a magnetic protagonist. In fact, Ben said that he got worried about God's reputation, calling and dealing with people like Jacob. But here in chapter 32, God appears to Jacob as a man who changes him and blesses him. God is with His people. Let me just review the backstory. Jacob married Leah and then Rachel. In Haran, they plus two maids bear 11 male children. Their 12th son, Benjamin, will be born after this in chapter 35, and Rachel dies in childbirth. These 12 sons will become the 12 tribes of Israel. Jacob flees Laban, his father-in-law, and that's recorded for us in chapter 31, and that episode is filled with tension and drama and pursuit. But ultimately, at the end of chapter 31, with some skill and tact and diplomacy under the hand of God, a covenant is made with Laban, and with a blessing, Laban and Jacob part ways. And Jacob returns to the land of promise, to Canaan. Now, this return journey from Haran means coming back into contact with Esau, Jacob's older brother, from whom he wrestled the birthright and the blessing, and then fled for 20 years. There's been no resolution so far in the story, no visits or emails to try and reconcile. There's what Jacob considers festering animosity. So here's what Jacob does in his great fear of reuniting with Esau. And I want you to notice that although he's scheming, he's actually taking initiative in a more humble way. First of all, God encounters him in the first two verses of chapter 32, which kind of sets up how God is going to be involved in this chapter, in this episode. And after this encounter with the angels, Jacob makes elaborate preparations to meet Esau. He sends messengers with a message of supreme courtesy. He uses the words, "my lord" and "your servant." He uses the phrase, "to find favor," which happens four times in two chapters on the lips of Jacob. And when we read the phrase to find favor, it's a formal expression when someone makes a request of a superior. So Jacob, quite unusually, given his past, is humbling himself before he even meets Esau. Then he gets the word back from his messengers, and the word is that Esau is coming with 400 people, which in that time period was a round number for a standard militia. And we read here in verse 7, if you just turn over to page 32, verse 7, you'll see it here. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And then intelligently, he divides his family to minimize the carnage. And then, in verses 9 to 12, Jacob prays. This is Jacob's first recorded prayer, and it's actually the longest prayer in Genesis. And you can see this here in verses 9 to 12. Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good,' I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with the children." And then you see what Jacob does in his prayers. He leans on the promises of God. Verse 12, "But you said, 'I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" So he prays in an attitude of humility, which comes from the recognition that he's totally dependent upon God. And for the first time, Jacob calls himself the servant of Esau and the servant of God. And then the next thing that he does to prepare for this meeting in verses 13 to 21 is this preparation of gifts. Notice this is a gift that he wants to give to Esau. He's not resorting to trickery or deceit the way that he would have done in the past. He's going to give him 550 animals, which in that culture, and probably today too, is a huge gift. It's a gift fit for royalty. Most of us wouldn't have room for 550 animals where we live. Esau, of course, has flocks already and herds, and this would just add to the wealth of his estate. And what Jacob seems to be doing is surrounding Esau with grace. It's a kind of a diplomatic attempt to pacify his brother. You see here in verse 18, when he instructs his messengers, he says to them, "You shall say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are presents sent to my lord Esau.'" Again, there's that servant language. Three times Jacob is going to come before Esau as his servant, even though Jacob is the one that has the blessing and the birthright and the promises of God. He surrenders himself. I had a conversation this week with a friend who's in a difficult situation, and one of the things that I was able to share with him from this text is that when you have been granted the blessings of God and the birthright of heaven and eternal life, you have the capacity to surrender yourself in humility in situations that you might encounter. And that's what Jacob does. He knows that God has made a promise, and he rests in that promise, and he surrenders himself before his brother. He can't control Esau, but he can humble himself. And then we read in verses 22 to 32 about this great struggle. And the struggle happened at night. And Jacob in verses 32 and 33 sends his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and sent them across the stream along with all of his possessions. And that's kind of symbolic, because when you cross the Jabbok, which flows into the Jordan, it was symbolic of entering the Promised Land. So here's Jacob, he's outside the Promised Land, and here's all of his family and possessions, and they've crossed into the Promised Land, and Jacob is left alone in the dark, unprotected, in danger, outside the Promised Land. It's as if he's not able to do that yet. Something else needs to happen. And Jacob isn't looking for a fight, but a man comes and begins to wrestle with him. And Jacob is thrown into complete despair. What is going on with this greatest wrestling match that ever occurs? It's a nighttime attack against Jacob. He doesn't have any possessions. He has no protection. It's just this strong man comes to him and wrestles with him. Who is this guy? In the Hebrew, the word for wrestle is a unique word that only appears here. And it is very much like what we would think of wrestling today as a sport. Grasping, great tension. I've wrestled once or twice. It was way back in high school. And actually, that's not true. I have wrestled with my sons at times, usually lost. The thing that strikes me about wrestling is that it's very sweaty. It's a combat sport that emphasizes strategic holds and grips and pins and throws. And by the time their struggle comes to an end, Jacob is convinced it's God himself that he's been struggling with. And in verse 25, we read this. This man who's been struggling with him, when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob. So this man, who I'm saying is God, must have calibrated his strength so that he didn't actually just completely defeat Jacob, but that wrestling match lasted for hours in the darkness. And in verse 26, finally, that man touches or strikes Jacob's hip. And the point is that this man, God, is teaching Jacob that God is really God and that Jacob is not. At this moment, Jacob is broken of his conceit and his self-reliance. And yet, you know what's surprising to me in this? In verse 26, the man says, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." That's a complete surprise to me. He's wounded now. He's a limping, wounded warrior. He no longer has the strength to take this battle to the very end. And yet he will not let go until he is blessed. The prophet Hosea speaks of this moment with this one verse. He strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. So Jacob isn't being arrogant when he says, "I won't let you go until you bless me." He's weeping. He's seeking the favor of God. "I won't let you go until you bless me." And then God says to him, "What is your name?" Now, in Hebrew culture, your name is your character. It's who you are. And Jacob replies, "Jacob." And in this case, of course, we know from history that Jacob is a name of shame. It's like a confession. "I'm Jacob. I'm a deceiver. I'm a grasper. I'm a schemer." But you see, this confession brings about a transforming grace, not just a blessing, but a name change, a new character. Israel, which means, and you can see it in the footnotes at the bottom of the page, it means he strives with God, or God strives. I mean, this is huge. It implies that Jacob has come to the end of himself. He stopped wrestling with God and started clinging to God. Jacob doesn't let go, but he strives or prevails now by prayer instead of by natural strength. The morning sun comes up and reveals a bruised and limping man, humbled by his God. Now he walks with a limp. Bruce Waltke, one of my professors at Regent, wrote this: "The limp is the posture of the saint, walking not in physical strength, but in spiritual strength." So this is the grace of God that will not let Jacob go. And brothers and sisters, if you are truly God's, you are also in the grip of his relentless grace. We're called to submit to him. And yet so many times we take things into our own hands and fail. And then Christ comes to us and cripples us in some way in his grace. And eventually we begin to yield to him. And what's important in, in the broader story is that Jacob, or Israel now, can only reconcile with his brother after God has dealt with him. And in chapter 33, we didn't read this, but you can look ahead for a few verses. Jacob approaches Esau without alarm, no longer as a malicious schemer, but as a gracious and skillful diplomat, expressing his feelings with sincerity and tact. And just look with me at verse 4 in chapter 33. Look what happens. It's absolutely wonderful. "But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." It's a beautiful reconciliation. It reminds me of the prodigal son and his loving father. So let me conclude this morning by making one application to us. It is God's power and presence that forms Israel, both the man and the people of faith who took his name. Israel is the name of God's people of faith in the Old Testament. Christians are those who are grafted into the people of Israel through faith in Christ. And just as God brings Jacob to his knees, Jesus must do the same with us, so that we know that he is God and we are not. But I find it very interesting in this narrative that Israel, the man, is still as ambitious as he ever was. Israel still strives with God. He's not passive, but his ambition is transformed and channeled by submission to God and prayer. And I've labeled this a great paradox. I want to suggest that for the church, this must mean that we are both ambitious before God as well as being submissive in prayer and obedience. And I think the modern challenge that we face today as a church is passivity, spiritual passivity. We live in an entertainment culture, a consumer culture. But God has called his people to be ambitious for the things of God and for his blessing. Frederick Bruner wrote about Jesus, this is referring to the parable of the faithful stewards. He writes, "Jesus does not quash ambition, he elevates it. The Christian is to be ambitious, passionate, acquisitive, enterprising for the Father's approval, for the well done of God's final judgment. Thus, Jesus' ethic is not so much ascetic as it is athletic." And I just think that's really interesting. This has spoken to me very deeply this week on that level. How is it in my own life that I am ambitious for God and for his blessing, while at the same time being submissive and prayerful? The two do work together, as evidenced by Jacob. So as you share in the Lord's Supper this morning or come up for a blessing, I want you to know that as you encounter Jesus Christ, you will be blessed and you will be changed. And in response to his transforming grace, what could it mean for you to live a life of faith that is ambitious for God's blessing to you and through you, and yet submissive to him in dependence and in prayer? And brothers and sisters, as we do that, we will see the face of God. Amen.